Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24. My guest today is a man who makes a stroll through the solar system seem like a walk in the park, who, despite being a theoretical physicist, is a phenomenal communicator and a best-selling author. Christophe Galfard spent his boyhood in France gazing at the sky, wondering, he says, what made it blue. He studied at Cambridge, where his supervisor was none other than Professor Stephen Hawking, with whom he's written a series of science books aimed at children. Solo and for grown-ups, Galfard has published The Universe in Your Hand, a wonderful book that imbues science with emotion and tells readers how the universe feels. A rare feat indeed. And I'm delighted to say that Christophe joins me here at Midori House in London. Christophe, thank you very much for joining us in the studio for the big interview today. There are literally billions of things we could talk about, all the atoms in the universe we could talk about today. So we've got to bide our time. I wanted to start off actually by talking about the books side of what you do, because people will, I mean, certainly in the UK, will be familiar with your name from those popular science books. And I wanted to ask if you set out with the idea of writing a popular science book, or whether it is your way of communicating that makes the science that you know popular.
I think it's extremely important to share with as many people as is possible what is known today through science for many reasons. One of them is it's people's money that is used to make those discoveries and all this research. And in a sense, that means that whatever is discovered through research belongs to everybody. So you need to get something back from this.
So there's a bit of accountability in there, almost.
Yeah, in a way. Okay. You, when your taxes are used to make roads, you do drive on those roads, so that there is a direct effect. For science, it's more indirect, but it does make feel you extremely good to understand what is known today. And that's what I'm going at now, which is that we as a species, humans, we share something that most of the other species, if maybe we're the only one, but most of the other species don't have, which is a curiosity about the universe, about what is around us. And I do believe...
Us and the monkeys.
Yeah, but they wouldn't look at the stars in the way
no,
we
indeed.
Do. Let's say we have technology on top. And,
yeah.
and thanks to that, we are able to forecast stuff that might happen in the future. As far as I know today, there is no other way but a scientific way to bias some kind of eternity, to protect us, to shield us from dangers, cosmic dangers or doomed evolution or things like that. So that sounds like something negative, but it is extremely positive, I believe.
So you're basically writing out some sort of insurance policy, some potential insurance policy for the future of humankind.
In a way, yes.
No small boast.
That's right.
Christophe.
in a way, if no one knows what science is about, which is more and more so, there is this kind of gap that widens decade after decade between the general public and the experts. And if that gap continues to widen, then the general public won't understand why we do these things anymore. And they won't understand why taxes go to these things. So it's kind of a snake that eats its own tail. You need to get that feedback to the general public. And now about its direct effect, I started writing books for children, kids' books.
And with the Hawkings?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was called George's Secret Key to the Universe. And since then, I've written some others, and I've met maybe 200,000, 300,000 kids throughout Europe in the past 5-6 years. I've never, ever seen a kid start to cry when he or she understands something. You smile.
Yes, indeed.
When you understand something, you smile.
Yeah.
You feel good. Your whole body feels good. I think that's part...
It's addictive
joy
as well, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
As you've mentioned children, let's rewind. Let's take the clock right back to your childhood, because you say, you know, when you're a kid and you suddenly learn something and you understand something, it's a buzz, right?
It is.
And it's addictive as well. We all know bright kids at school or whoever you are, it's suddenly putting the square peg in the square hole is a very satisfying thing to suddenly be able to do. Tell us a little bit about that for you. Were you a stargazing kid? Were you kind of into creepy crawlies? Insects, that is. I don't know whether that translates very well.
No.
What sort of, were you looking down on the ground or were you looking up at the heavens when you were a kid?
Well, I think I was a pretty normal kid with my problems and joys and sorrows and all these things. I wasn't particularly good at school. I was good at maths, but not always, sometimes. I could feel the joy when I understood, and I could feel the pain when I didn't. And the pain you don't want, the joy you do want, so when you have both, it's tricky to know what you want to do. But there is something that I believe all kids are fascinated with, which is nature itself. As you said, insects or stargazing or anything, but even the wind that blows on your face or the clouds that drift in the sky. Everything is a source of wonder. You ask questions. Why? You piss off your parents asking questions all the time. But the point is that you are curious. It is in there. Whereas as an adult, later on, you think you've learned stuff. It's much more difficult to open yourself up to new knowledge or to knowledge that you didn't have, because you first have to break down all these things you do believe, which are not true.
You were the kid that you saw the clouds scurrying across the sky and you wondered why. So there's a kind of kid that turns into Shakespeare and says, you know, shall I compare thee to a summer's day or whatever? And then there's Isaac Newton, for example, who looks up at the clouds and thinks a very different thought. When did you know that you were going to be more on the scientific than the poetic side of this? And I will come onto the style and prose of your books in a bit, because you have managed to fuse the two very successfully. But when did you know that you were on the scientific than the poetic side of
this? I'll answer what you said in the middle. I don't see why those two domains of human knowledge should be opposed. I don't see why they should be excluded. Some of the most imaginative and poetic people I know are scientists, and some of the most unimaginative people I know are poets, in a way. So in both, everything we do in these fields is to try and understand or explicit some sensibility that you might have about the universe, the reality, the world. We have our senses from our bodies that enable us to receive some kind of information from our environment, wherever that information comes from. Light from the stars, that's light that's been traveling in space for billions of years sometimes, or just the chair you're sitting on right now, you can feel it. Poets and physicists and other scientific or anybody, if you stick to what we perceive, you don't go very far. Even science today.
So you're always looking behind it. You're looking for the reason why. You're looking for the
something deeper.
The force that is exerting you to stay up on your chair. You're thinking of the reason behind rather than simply being satisfied with sitting in a chair.
And in science, the thing is that for a bit more than 100 years, maybe even more than that, we kind of can explain everything that is within the reach of our senses. That's done. So what science is about today is what's beyond our senses. And every time, at every different epoch in the history of mankind, there is a limit to the knowledge of that epoch. Beyond that, before it was called metaphysics, beyond the physics, today I call it theoretical physics. That's where theoretical physics starts, where we do not know anything anymore. And to peruse those unspoiled territory, uncharted territories, you only have one tool, which is your imagination. You have to make things up.
And that's a very interesting thing. And I suppose that is where the imagination and what we've called at the beginning of this interview, the more poetic side of things, fuses with the physics and the mathematical side of things, the scientific side of things. And there is an idea of inventing, not inventing new worlds, but visualizing the world that is beyond the one we live in, or the one that makes up the world that we do live in. This is something that you do very successfully at the beginning of your book, The Universe in Your Hand. Where I felt reading that you give a great sense of the feel of physics, actually, rather than the mathematics of physics.
Physics is not as cold and remote from our senses and emotions as some might believe. It is very human. And again, when you understand something, you smile. Again, when you know suddenly why the sky is blue, doesn't take off the poetry of a sunset. It adds some beauty to it. It doesn't erase what you felt before. You have an extra feel, an extra sense to apprehend all these things. Not to have those, I think, would be a loss.
You opened up talking about the fact that there is a great chasm at the moment between the public understanding of science and scientists' understanding of science. And people might go, well, obviously, that's the case. But I wonder if there was a sort of golden age, maybe it was in the 20th century, I'm presuming it probably was, when that chasm was just a gap, when it was much closer, when there was an understanding, when people had a more ready understanding of the world and science hadn't sort of left them for dust.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I think it's always been the same.
I wonder whether studying theoretical science, you can't see it and feel it. You can't look out even into the stars and see it. That you have a harder sell to the man in the street with your science than you might have before.
That might be the case, because far too often I hear people in talks and events I go to where people ask me, why on earth do we spend billions of dollars on such ridiculously vain topics such as stars and whatever, rather than feed the world? Well, that's a wrong question, I believe. First of all, the amount of money that is spent on research and science is ridiculous compared to the GDP of countries. It's even ridiculous compared to what is put into army and other things. But that's not the real reason. First of all, if you really do need reasons to do this research, okay, let me put it this way. A few years ago, I was with Professor Hawking, and I was asking him about how was it during the Cold War? How did you work? Were you allowed to work with Russian? With the West was allowed to work with the East and vice versa? How did it work? And he told me that it was completely forbidden, and that there was an iron curtain on knowledge as well. Scientists from either side were not allowed to speak with the other side, but they did anyway. They kept trying to understand where the universe came from, why birds fly, why the sky is blue, and all these things. They kept working, regardless of their political views. They probably didn't have that many. Meaning, what I want to say with this is that science doesn't care about your culture. It doesn't care about your skin color. It doesn't care about your language. It is universal. It is human. And it belongs to everybody again. And it does bring opposites together. In any theoretical physics department you might go to around the world, you'll see people from everywhere, from all religions, and they all speak the same language. I do believe in the source of peaceful thought. And that's the kind of stuff that we, it seems to me, need these days.
I wonder whether if the Chinese build a telescope, or they pay for it to be built, or they are the largest sort of shareholders in this big thing, do they get to use it first? How does stuff like that work? I mean, can you rock up? You've got a reputation. You're a well-known man. Can you rock up and go, well, actually, I need this guy for a couple of months. I need to step in here. What the sharing of resources work, I wonder?
Well, you see, usually the way it works is that it's proportional to how you funded the object. If you're 100% funding something, you have 100% of the time. And if you pay for parts that are used within a telescope, then you get your share of
slots.
So
it's sort of renting out the spare room, yeah, even in space telescope.
Exactly. And that's okay. One of the things, for instance, when you think about it, you'd think that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, for instance, is something that would take a lot of time from telescopes all around the world. Well, it's not the case. I think, I may be wrong, but I think the order of magnitude is that a few dozens of hours out of all the telescopes on Earth are devoted to finding these signals every year. That's nothing. And that's one of the reasons Yuri Milner and Stephen Hawking announced a few months ago that they would fund that research, in particular by booking some time on those telescopes to be able to look. Even the SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, the huge dish, the one that appears in James Bond, even that one, which was built in the first place for that reason, they can't afford to look for these signals all the time because they don't see any signals like that. So,
I suppose it's one of those things that captures people's imaginations. But is this a preoccupation of scientists, or is this a preoccupation of trying to make science popular, I wonder?
You know what I mean? Aliens?
Yeah, looking for little green men.
But there is something that's changed recently about that. If we were 30 years ago, you were to ask me the same question, I'd pretty much say, it would really be finding a needle in a haystack, and Even then, we wouldn't even be sure. But that's changed. For instance, the first planet ever discovered that revolves around a star which is not the Sun was in 1994, 22 years ago. Not 1,000 years ago, 22 years ago. We know about the planets that orbit the Sun, but I'm talking about another star, another Sun. We've believed that there were some, but the first proof was 1994. Since then, we've confirmed the existence of more than 3,800 planets, and we still have more than 4,000 candidates, and we've only looked at a very, very tiny portion of the sky. So we estimate that there are around 2-3 planets per stars in our galaxy. Just within the Milky Way, this amounts to about something between 400 and 1,000 billion planets. So there are planets everywhere.
It is the Euro Millions of solar systems.
Sort of. But the important thing about that is that even 10 years ago, even if we found those planets, we wouldn't have been able to look at them. Now that technology is arriving. The next generation of satellites that are going to be sent into space will be able to detect the composition of the atmosphere if there is one of those planets, of candidate planets. That will make us able to detect maybe some signs of life. Indirectly, yes, but it's the beginning of a new science, which is exobiology. When you have exo means on another world.
Yeah, exobiology. See, and this is the stuff presumably that gets people interested, that makes children smile, the rest of it.
Exactly.
But, and just finally on this topic, what happens when you find a little sort of microbe crawling across a test tube slide rather than some sort of magnificent other race? That's always the problem, isn't it? Because people want invaders from Mars. You know, they don't necessarily want to go, oh, right, there's something that looks a bit like a slug that we found. Yeah, we found 4 squillion light years away. That's what happens, because I suppose there is the management of expectation of the public as well, whether they're taxpayers or not, just how excited people get by this very scientific but also very sort of science fictional bugbear that people
you've watched Independence Day 2 already, haven't you?
There haven't been quite enough rainy Sundays for that one to get onto the DVD player, to be honest. But you know what I mean? Do you have to manage expectation when the likelihood is that you're going to see a squiggle on the test tube slide rather than something that the popular imagination has taught us to see?
First of all, if you have it on a test tube, means you've managed to bring it back on Earth, which is not at all.
Well, I'm
in
doing
our
all
technology.
That work for you. Come on.
Okay, fair enough. But that's one of the things I try to do, in the sense that I'm not 100% in agreement with all these announcements that are made every month or other month or year by people like NASA, who say that we found another Earth, we got another planet down there. I don't like these announcements for two reasons. One, they're wrong. We've never found a planet exactly like the Earth, but it's a catchy title, so it sells, etc. But it has a back reaction, which is negative, which is that when we find that planet, people will say, oh, okay, we've known that for years. Well, no, it's not true. We haven't found another Earth. We've found potential planets much bigger than the Earth that may be in the right place for water to be liquid on the surface, but we have no clue yet. So one should be careful with what one announces, so that the expectation still is there. And once it comes, you don't have to say something even more. Once you've said we found another Earth, which was not true, what will you say when we find one? You would say that we found a place where there is life, but you haven't checked yet. And once you find life, you'll say they're attacking us just to sell some new stories. So you have to be careful about what you say. And I think what's dear to me is to trust people's intelligence, the public's intelligence. People understand everything. Honestly, they do. Just don't bullshit them. Just say what we have. Say what we're talking about science. We're not talking about PR for a politician campaign or anything. We're talking about science, about knowledge.
And what about, and your tone of voice is quite novelistic, actually, in the way that you write, certainly in the Universe in Your Hand. You start off, as I say, you write about how physics and how science feels, which is a very rare trick to be able to do, a very rare thing to be able to pull off. Where did that tone of voice come from?
Actually, I love adventure books. Mm-hmm. I love stories. And it's important not to lure ourselves either, because one of the things we as human like most is a good story. We need stories to make sense of our lives. These stories have been myths for a long time. My point of view is that today, the story we tell about ourselves comes from physics. That's the story of our universe. That's the story about life. It's not anymore the turtle coming out of a pond and being eaten by a crocodile that gave... These myths helped for a long time, and they were based on many symbols, very deep sometimes. But this is a different way of telling a story altogether. It is still a story, but it's based on new parts of realities that have been discovered recently. And putting the two together, all these adventure stories that I love, even Jules Verne did this kind of things a century ago. And I like that way of trying to titillate the mind by telling a story that opens up your imagination rather than shrinking it like a clam.
Like a black hole.
Like those shellfish that close up when you get close to them. If you meet somebody in the street and said, listen, I'm going to talk to you about four-dimensional pseudo-Riemannian manifolds in 4+1 dimensions, and their mind goes like, whoa, that's gone. But if you tell them that maybe there is an extra dimension in our universe, and maybe because of that extra dimension, we can understand why light goes from you to me and interacts and stuff. And that's different ways to say exactly the same thing. So you have to know what you want to do. What I want to do is to share today's knowledge through a story. And for that, you don't have the choice. You have to tell a story.
Okay, well, I think it's time before we go, before we finish up, should we have a potted history of something like a black hole, a well-known thing that people kind of go, what on earth? I think I should know this, but I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. What exploded to make the Big Bang?
What exploded to make the Big Bang?
Exploded? What was it in the first place?
There is some kind of answer in your question, as if there was something before that. So let me put it the other way
around.
I'm
a straightforward kind of guy.
Let me put it the other way around. The idea of a Big Bang came about from Einstein's equations, but that had no experimental basis in the first place. But then
it's a pure theory, I suppose, at this point.
Yeah. But then, and that's why Einstein didn't even believe in that. But then experimental proof came about, and now it seems to be the correct theory. So let me tell you what that means. When you look at the stars up there with a telescope and the stars in faraway galaxies, what you will realize pretty fast is that all the faraway galaxies are moving away from you all the time. And the further they are, the faster they are moving away. This is what has been called the expansion of the universe, that it grows up. So one thing you could deduce from that experimental fact is that you are at the center of the universe because everything is moving away from you. But that's not how it's been interpreted. What people have thought is that actually those faraway galaxies are not moving at all. These galaxies, they are there, it's fine. What is changing is the distance that separates them from us. So that distance is stretching. And when you switch to that point of view, you can settle in a galaxy at the other side of the universe. The distances will still stretch, meaning that all the faraway galaxies from there will move away from you there. So you will again think you are at the center of the universe. The expansion of the universe is this. It is that the distances between faraway galaxies is growing. It's stretched. So that's the first part. Now, from this, what scientists have deduced is that since things are moving away from each other now because distances are stretched, if you rewind time, things were closer to one another in the past. And if you do that as far back as you can, you reach a moment when all the energy that you can see in outer space is so packed in such a small place that even your theory of gravity breaks down, meaning that you're not even able to use the concepts of space and time. And in a sense, that's what we call the Big Bang. The Big Bang is when space and time vanish from our equations. They do not exist anymore. It's the birth of space and time. Now, to go back to your question, if we define the Big Bang as the birth of space and time, are you really allowed to talk about before time existed?
I see. That's a scientist's rhetorical question.
But that, in a way, that's where some of the problems we have with problems, actually, the joys that scientists have today is to try to find.
You're trying to find adequate definitions all the time, aren't you?
Not necessarily definition, but the adequate language, mathematical language. To reach beyond what we have today. And that language needs to obey some very precise rule, which we haven't yet found. That's the search for the theory of everything that would unify gravity and all the other three quantum forces that we have in nature.
Now that you have a wonderful reputation for communication, for making these difficult concepts or making things that people think are difficult easier to understand and writing these successful books, do you feel that now you have a responsibility actually to do that? Do you feel a bit of pressure on your next book on trying to make it even simpler, even more human, I wonder?
Well, no.
Okay, no, it's
not at all.
Good answer.
What I picked up for my next book is a topic I would like to learn about. I don't know if you've heard of that Professor Steven Weinberg. He's a Nobel Prize winner, one of the brightest scientists alive today. A really, really, really bright guy.
Okay.
Yeah, bright. And he said one day, well, when you're a professor and want to learn about something, you just volunteer to teach a course and you just try to be 1 week ahead of your students.
Okay. So that's nice and honest.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I want to learn for myself first and then share that knowledge with the rest. There are many topics. It's not just the one there. Many topics that we need to share with everybody.
So what is the next? What's the next topic? What's the thing you don't know enough about?
I'll be back to talk about it.
Okay, this will be Christoph Gaffard talking about how on earth do you get the right consistency of homemade pasta? We had to end on something stupid. I'm sure there is a string theory to making the perfect spaghetti. We haven't got that far today. For the time being, thank you so much for talking us through literally the life, the universe and everything, Christoph Gaffard. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bound, in conversation with Christoph Gaffard. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luty, researched by Gaia Lutz, and edited by Claire Crofton. That's it for this season, but The Big Interview will be back in the autumn for season 4. Until then, head to monocle.com to listen back through the archives. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.